Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 2, "And when I came to you, brothers, I did not come to you proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. And my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith may not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Yet among the mature, we do impart wisdom, although it's not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age, who are doomed to pass away. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. The things God has revealed to us through the Spirit, these things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. For who knows a person's thought except the spirit of that person which is in him? So also, no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Now, we have received not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but by taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual person judges all things, but is himself to be judged by no one. For who has understood the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." Well, there is an extraordinary chapter of the Bible that is well worth careful study, which we're not going to do tonight. Last week we looked at apologetics and categoria, and there was a two-page handout for you at the end of the night, which I hope you enjoyed reading. This week there is a four-page handout for you at the end of the night, which is better set out, but is also, I think, one of those essays to read afterwards. I don't know if any of you have questions from last week's essay that you left mystified about and want to ask me of, but we'll press on, speaking of where we're up to last week. Now, last week, if I remember, we saw just the meaning of some key words. So, yes, away we go on this. That is, apologetics is reasoned defense of your position. So as you preach the gospel, people attack what you say, disagree, argue with what you say. Apologetics is the reasoned defense. Categoria is the reasoned attack. You don't have to wait for people to tell you what's wrong with you. You can start telling them what's wrong with them. And so in categoria, you attack what the world is saying. Evangelism is proclamation. For as Paul said, we didn't come with clever arguments. We came proclaiming Christ and him crucified. But if you do proclaim Christ and him crucified, you've got to expect people are going to ask you questions. They're going to disagree with you. You're going to say, but what about this? But what about that? So you've got to be able to defend that. Although I want to commend to you that in your defending of it, sometimes you need to say, yeah, and without this, this doesn't make sense and that doesn't make sense and so forth. So at the end of last time, I was talking to you about the circle of truth and the tangents that touch the world. That is, the truth of the gospel is circular. The Bible says the Bible's the word of God. It's a circular argument. There is no authority above the Bible. There can be no authority above the Bible. Otherwise, the Bible's not the authority. And so reason can't prove the truth that the Bible is the word of God. Otherwise, reason is the authority to which the Bible must bow. So there is a Christianity is circular. But that doesn't mean it's irrational to believe it. That doesn't mean that you've got to go in for what is called fideism, a jump into the dark of hoping that it's right. Because the Bible touches the world in many, many ways. I've just put three tangents up there because I was rather impressed with myself that I could draw three tangents, and I thought I wouldn't try my luck with a fourth. But there are hundreds and hundreds of tangents where this circle of truth touch upon the statements of the world. And the way onto the circle of truth is along those tangents. Any one of the tangents will lead you onto the circle of truth. The trouble is, of course, the tangent that leads you on is also the tangent that can lead you off the circle of truth. Because the arguments always run two ways. Now, let me illustrate it for you. Take the subject of the creation of the world. Either the world, I'll give you two alternatives, we may be able to think of others, but the two common ones, either the world was created by the personal God, or the world is a big accident. At the moment, most people think that the world has come from a Big Bang. Either God created the Big Bang, or just out of random accident, a bang happened. Thousands of years, millions of years later, it has turned into what we are today. As the universe expands and as a little bit of it cools down and water comes up, either God created the world through this mechanism, well, until we found a better way of describing what's happened, either God was personally involved in doing it, as the Bible would teach he's created, or it's all just an accident. There is no God. Now, there's two options that are available, the atheist option and the theist option. How can you pick which is right? Because both are looking at the evidence of the Big Bang and coming to the same conclusion, but one says there's something beyond the Big Bang, whereas the other says there's nothing beyond the Big Bang. Well, nothing we can know about anyway. One says that we now then are owned. The other says we are free. You see, if God is a personal God who has created the world purposefully and intentionally, he has created us personally and intentionally, and we are owned by him. We are his. We've been made by him. We've been made for him. And therefore, we are answerable to him and responsible to him. Of course, if there is no God and it's all just a big accident, well then, we're free. We can do exactly like we like because we're not owned by anybody. I'm only answerable to myself. I can do whatever I like. It's totally my life that I've got here. You can see in that, atheism is very attractive, especially to a kind of freedom-loving, pleasure-seeking world. Atheism is very attractive. I'm not answerable to anybody else but me. I live, I eat, I drink, I die. I should make merry while I can. Very attractive. But look at the downside of this, the other side. Because I am free and I'm just part of the huge accident of the universe, then I am meaningless. Because accidents are meaningless. That's their very nature. That's their very capital. They happen because they happen because they happen because they happen. There's no reason they happen. They just happened. And so the whole universe is meaningless. And every part of the universe is ultimately meaningless. It's meaningless I was born. It's meaningless that I live. It's meaningless that I die. I just happen to be part of a huge accident. And here I am. And anything I do and everything I do is ultimately meaningless. There is no love, there is no justice, there is no truth, there's no faithfulness. All those are things are created by people in power to manipulate me to behave in certain fashions. But I'm free. I don't have to do that. I don't have to love people. I can hate people if I want to. I don't have to seek justice, especially if I'm strong and powerful. I can rule over people and treat them any way I like. And so the really consistent, hardline atheists, Nietzsche, Ayn Rand, for example, Ayn Rand has written up in this morning's paper, she outsells Germaine Greer by a factor of five, even to this day, and is argued in the article that I read in the paper this morning as being the single most significant person, powerful woman of the 20th century. Now, she's a thoroughgoing atheist, extreme economic rationalist, and for her, life is to the strong. You know, the ethical self-interest is what she writes about. The ethics of looking after number one. Because there is no God. I'm not answerable to anybody or anything other than me. And if you don't like that, well, that's your problem. And if you want to be nice and kind and gentle to me, well, go ahead. I don't care. I mean, it's an irrelevance. Just because you're stupid, don't ask me to be. And so you have this incredible philosophical system of accidentalism, where everything is meaningless. And so the only meaning that exists is the meaning I make up. On the other hand, if we are created by God, a personal God, then we are meaningful. We have the meaning that He gives to us. This lump of perspex that I've got in front of me is a lump of perspex. If it just accidentally came into existence, then it has no meaning. But it has a meaning. But where does it get its meaning from? It doesn't get its meaning from its perspectiveness, or however that word would be. It gets its meaning from its manufacturer. He's made it to do certain things. And it gets its meaning from its owner, the cathedral. It gets its meaning from its user, the present speaker. I could use it for something else. I'm not quite sure what I could use it for, because it's been made to be used in one way, but I suppose I could use it to rest my coffee cup. I could use it to bash someone over the head with. It'd be a pretty blunt and stupid instrument, but I could, couldn't I? It itself has no meaning other than the meaning I give it. But because it is owned by somebody and made by somebody, it has got the meaning that the owner and maker gives it. So it is with me. Because I've been made by God, I'm a manufactured item called a human. Because I've been owned by God, I am responsible to Him to do and to live the way He has made me to live. And therefore my life becomes meaningful, the meaning that He has given to me in my manufacture and in my ownership, or His ownership of me. Here is the tangent, you see. If you ask the question, what is the meaning of life? That is a tangent that will lead you onto the circle of truth. Because the circle of truth says God has created you, and that's why you have a meaning, and there is a meaning to life. But of course, that will mean that someone might be on the circle of truth and say, hang on, I want to get off here, because that means I've got to do what God wants me to do. And so the very circle that led them on is the circle that leads, is the tangent that leads them off. Tangent that gets them on is the tangent that gets them off. Or if you go the other way and say, well, look, life is meaningless. There's a good categoria argument, see? Life is meaningless. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And here's modern art. Here is modern playwrights like Camus and Sartre and Beckett waiting for Godot. Life is meaningless. Well, that's a stupid way. How can you really treat life as meaningless? And so you argue and say, no, I can show you meaning in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ and in your creation. But of course, once I've accepted meaning, I'm no longer free to make it up the way I want to. Do you see how tangents touch upon the circle? So by discussing meaning, by discussing creation, I can actually bring people onto the circle of truth. But you can see why also the atheists are very keen on arguing against creation. Why they're so keen on their doctrine of evolution. Now, do not mishear me. I'm not saying evolution is wrong, but I'm saying atheists are very keen on it because it gives them an alternative to creation, an alternative which then allows them to be free to do what they want to do rather than answerable to God. Okay. Are you happy in understanding the connection between circles and tangents as I'm using it? There we are. I thought I saw a glass of water appearing somewhere. It's half gone. Happy enough with that? I'll take you on the next step then. It's all gone. I want to talk about different forms of knowledge. How do we know what we know? There's different ways of argument. Now, these are words, famous words, but let me just take you through some definitions. It will help you in the reading and the understanding of the essay later. It's more than just words, though. Words clothe logic. Thanks, a chair would be really good, Brian. That's really wonderful, Brian. Words clothe logic. So, the first one I'll take you to is deductive. Deductive reasoning is to infer from principles to examples. To infer means to draw out the information, but you're drawing it from basic principles to particular examples. So, mathematics is a classic deductive system. There are basic principles in mathematics from which you can infer that 2 plus 2 equals 4. 3 plus 1 equals 4. 4 minus 3 equals 1. You can get all kinds of examples that you've deduced from basic principles. Chess is a deductive system. That enables you to know that because this bishop is standing on a black square, he can move diagonally in any one of four directions, but only on black squares. Whereas the one standing on the white squares can only move on the white squares. So the black one can never capture the white one can never catch the black one, because there are basic principles of how chess operates, and you've just got examples of them. The wonderful thing about deduction is you get absolute right answers, right and wrong answers. Things are either right or they're wrong. The basic problem with deduction is it's a circle of truth that has got no necessary tangent to the world. Mathematics has the same logic status as chess. You don't think the world operates on the basis of chess. There are some fanatics who think it does, but you don't think that it actually operates that way. There's no reason for it to operate mathematically either. Although one of the little conundrum problems for people is why can you apply pure maths? Because if it's really pure, there's no reason for it to be applied. And yet it is. That's a little mathematical conundrum the unbeliever has. Second method, of course, is induction, the opposite one. That is, you infer from facts to principles. So you establish certain things are true, and on the basis of these things, the facts that you've established are true, you then draw up some general theory of relativity that may come, or some general theory of how infections take. So you look at hundreds and hundreds of people who are infected and you try and work out what they have in common so that you can work out some kind of principle as how infection, as opposed to contagion, may be spread. The two kinds of methods of operation that connect with those are, firstly, I think I've got rationalism, haven't I, as the next one. Rationalism is all based on principles. A rational decision is one that is based on the logic and principles. It may have nothing to do with life, because it's just based on logic. Though it could have, because you've started with some principle that you may have got from inference, from induction. You've now come to a principle, and on the basis of that principle, you make rational conclusions. But rationality is logic. It's moving from principles. The opposite to it is empiricism. I know you could have got all these out of the dictionary. You didn't have to come tonight to hear these. They're just words, but it's not just words. It's the way we think, often without realising how we're thinking. Sometimes we've been trained to think like this, trained to actually analyse it, like I'm trying to train you now to analyse it, but often people just think. They haven't worked out how they do it. Empiricism is based on observation. And so again, it's the flip side of rationalism. That is, in rationalism, I sit down and think about things. In empiricism, I go out and have a look at things and weigh them and measure them and try and analyse them and see their colours. Now, the ancient philosophy of the world, or the Aristotelian philosophies for the world, were basically rationalism. Whereas the modern sciences of the world are basically empiricism. But can you see, all these four things I've got up there so far, they all work together. Now, rationalism is a deduction system and empiricism is an induction system, but you can't really empirically investigate things without rationally thinking about them. And as you rationally think about things, you'll start to go out and look to see whether it's true or not. Weigh and measure and try and evaluate whether it's true or not. But you've got to understand the different process of thinking. With rationalism and deduction, you can get absolute right-wrong answers. With induction and empiricism, you get real-life answers, but they mightn't be right. And so we're always changing our opinion scientifically as we learn more. So we think this is the truth because given the evidences we've got at the moment, this is the best explanation we've got. But then someone goes out and finds something else. And so we change what's happening. When I was a child, I got croup very badly. Hands up those of you who have ever had croup. There you go, the world has changed. I got croup. Croup is a terrible cough that can't be broken that little children have. You grow out of it by the age of 6 or 7. I had it till I was 15. And it's just you cough and cough and cough and it... Thank you. And it's more like a bark. Once you've heard a croup cough, you know a croup cough. And the way of curing it was, apart from taking sulphur tablets, which they don't give you now, was to hang your head under a towel over a basin of steaming water with Friar's balsam in it. And there was this foul-smelling Friar's balsam would come up into your nostrils, into your mouth, and down into the into the cords, and it would break up the croupy cough that you had. And so I spent hours under towels, tea towels, over basins, smelling Friar's balsam. It's a dreadful smell. However, further research has established that the way that Friar's balsam successfully treated croup was by being in steam. And in fact, it wasn't the Friar's balsam, it was just the steam that broke up the croupy cough. And you didn't need it. And so today what they do is they stick the child into a shower and just let them have a steamed in the bathroom somewhere, and that's just as good, and there's none of that foul-smelling stuff that I was inflicted on for 15 years. And when I get to heaven, I've got something to tell my mother. This is classic empiricism. We know what we know about the world, and it's real. It's not mathematical. It's not like chess. But we never actually know that we know it, because the next experiment might show something different, might show something more. In fact, we hope that it will. And so science never can actually come to the final conclusion that this is the truth. All it can say is, to the best of our knowledge, this is the truth. Whereas mathematicians, they can say this is the truth. 2 + 2 = 4, and I don't care what experiment you do tomorrow, it will still be 4. Because that's by principle, by nature, by definition, it has to be. Happy? Everyone understands the difference between these? But that's not the only way in which we know things. Most people think those thoughts, whether they've articulated it or not, but they've got that much. But there are other methods of knowledge. Intuition. Intuition is a very, very powerful form of knowledge. It's the kind of, what have I called it, apprehension without thought. It's apprehending, it's understanding, it's perceiving what the truth is without any thinking, without any rational reflection, without any empirical reflection. Now, where do you see this? Well, classically is where you don't see it. That is, did you ever watch the movie Rain Man? Or the story of the autistic person? People suffering on the autism spectrum significantly lack intuition. They're very good at rational reflection. They can be extraordinarily accurate in their perception of information, but they haven't got that intuition that knows what to do with it. And especially, therefore, they lack what is called emotional intelligence. The kind of emotional intelligence that enables you to relate to another person and be able to intuitively know what that other person is thinking or feeling. And so their relationships get very stunted and thwarted because they don't get what the other person is feeling or experiencing or perceiving, which you and I, if you are not autistic, we get intuitively. I read your face, I see your body language, I project how I feel on how you would feel in the same situation. Another place you get it is in humour. Sense of humour is nearly always irrational. It's not a scientific investigation. And sense of humour is often where people connect with each other, isn't it? As a speaker, if I want to get the crowd on side with me, I start with a joke. You notice I didn't care about you because I didn't start with a joke. But if you want to get people on side, you start with a joke, because there's something very human, very personal, very irrational about laughing with each other. Right? We enjoy each other's company in laughter. The sense of intuition is an important part of understanding. It's an important part of knowledge. Now, most scientists don't talk about it. The psychologists are really fighting as to whether there is a thing called emotional intelligence or not. But the companies are all running tests on emotional intelligence because they know that people with high emotional intelligence are good workers and people with low emotional intelligence are really good in front of a computer screen. Right? You don't actually have to connect with anybody or relate to anybody. You just have to look at the facts and the figures. But as a salesman, someone without emotional intelligence is a dead loss. And so the world is very interested in emotional intelligence, but the scientists find it a strange concept because it's an intuitive thing that doesn't fit into rationalism or empiricism. There's another way of knowing, that is tradition. Tradition is a way of knowing things because it's been handed down to you from your forefathers. Now, people can scorn tradition because, after all, lots of things are handed down that aren't true. And you can't just believe it because you were told it. But a huge amount of what you and I know and believe, we know and believe because our parents or our teachers told us. There's mountains. Every piece of information that you are given, you don't have to go out and investigate for yourself to find out if it's true. You know, Captain Cook landed here in 1770. How do you know? Well, because you were told it. That's how you know. I mean, you weren't around. You haven't got the original film of it. You just know that it's true. You could empirically go and test that if you needed to. But, you know, like most empiricism, it can't be proved absolutely. You can't prove anything absolutely by empiricism. So historical knowledge is always in part traditional. It can be evaluated by empiricism, but it's tradition that Captain Cook landed here in 1770. And we know lots of information by tradition. And then there's a last way that I want to mention to you, which is, of course, the critical one for this whole discussion: revelation. We know by revelation. What is revelation? Revelation is being told what is hidden. Being told what is hidden. Now, there's all kinds of things hidden in my left-hand pocket. What is in my left-hand pocket? You can't see it. You can't know it. My hand, that's one thing. Unless I've lost it recently. Handkerchief? Handkerchief is a good piece of intuition, right? Because you didn't know. But now I've shown it to you. And in showing it to you, I've revealed it to you. But there are other things in my left-hand pocket. Well, what are the other things that are known in my pocket? Well, there's a whole series of business cards kept in my left-hand pocket. And there is a tape recorder in my left-hand pocket. So far, these are relatively predictable things for a speaker, aren't they? What else is in my left-hand pocket? And we'll be here a long time. Fruit lozenge. Very close. That's in my right-hand pocket. I always keep them on this side. My keys are in my right hand. I'm very organised in what I have in my pockets. Always carry this in my left-hand pocket. All set of trousers I've got this in my left-hand pocket. If you know, you know because I've shown you. But you will never, I think, well, you could by random chance guess it, but you won't know it. In my left-hand pocket is a series of medicines that I take in case I get gallstone attacks, because over a period of time I got a whole series of gallstone attacks, and they are extraordinarily painful and you never know when they're going to come upon you. And so I always carry my anti-gallstone attack medicines with me in my left-hand pocket. If you ever got a gallstone attack and I'm around, ask me. I'll share them with you quite freely, because you'll have total sympathy from me, because gallstones are appalling. So I've always got that in my pocket, even though I haven't had an attack for 18 months now, I still have it in my pocket. And if you've ever had a gallstone attack, you'll know why I have it in my pocket, because they are really bad news. That's revelation, you see. But you see, I've revealed something more than just what's in my pocket, haven't I? I've revealed something about myself, haven't I? I've revealed that I've had gallstone attacks over a long period of time. I've revealed that I'm a coward. I'm afraid of gallstone attacks. I've revealed that I found them very painful. I've revealed that I'm a relatively organised person. Certain things in one pocket, certain things in other pockets. I've revealed myself, haven't I? That is, you could find out what was in my pockets by empiricism. Hold me down, pull out the pockets, see what's there. That would be an empirical approach. You couldn't work out what's in my pockets by rationalism, just sitting there thinking up. You'd have a guess, but you couldn't know. But you cannot find out what I'm like as a person by either empiricism or rationalism. You only discover that as I talk to you. As I talk to you, I show what I'm like. I reveal what I'm like. That is, the only way you know a person is by revelation. Now that's what I read to you from 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Look what Paul says there in verse 11. For who knows a person's thoughts except the spirit of that person which is in him? So also, no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. The only way to know a person is by revelation. I know ideas by deduction. I know of the world's facts, objects, by empiricism. I know how to relate to you by intuition. But I know you as a person if you personally reveal yourself to me. Now, God is a personal God. The only way we'll know the person of God is by God revealing himself to us. And so that is what he has done. He refuses to be known by the wisdom of man and chooses to be known by revealing himself to whomever he wishes. See, I've revealed myself to you. I've told you all kinds of things about myself. Some of you haven't told me anything about yourself. And you can go through life like that if you want to. But if you go through life like that, do you know what? You and I won't ever be friends, will we? Because I don't know you. You've retained your own privacy, but you have denied me the possibility of friendship. To have friends, you have to reveal yourself. You have to show what you're like. You have to tell what is inside you as a person. And so I can know who you are by knowing, well, that's the face that goes with that name, but I don't know you. But as you tell me about you, so you get to say, oh, I know him. I know her. There's the difference. Well, how do you know God? You can't know him as an object, and you can't know him by rational reflection. You may by intuition, you may by tradition, but ultimately it's by revelation. It's by God choosing to make himself known to us. Now, all that will help you, I think, understanding the relationship between revelation, apologetics, and categoria,